Hello and welcome to Helting FM, the podcast for law, technology and media. This is pod number 26 and it's certainly a very special edition. We invited two colleagues from Kyiv to speak about their experiences during this terrible war, personally as well as professionally. With me today again is Marlene Schreiber, whom you should know from our last edition where we spoke about whistleblowing hotlines. Hello, Marlene.
Hi, Martin.
We're very happy and also very proud to have Oleksiy Stolyarenko and Nazar Chernyavsky with us today. Hello, Oleksiy.
Hello.
And welcome, Nazar.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
But both of you are friends we've known from international conferences and working groups. Almost exactly 3 years ago, I spoke on data protection laws in Germany at the third International IT Law Conference in Kyiv that was organized by colleagues from Kyiv. And if I recall correctly, both of you were speakers at this conference. And I have this, I remember this as one of the liveliest, youngest, and actually most female conferences on IT law I have visited. And just recently, we were talking about having a sixth edition on like 2 weeks from now, which is just crazy to how quickly things went downhill. Now the world in Kyiv is an unbelievable different place. Before we start hearing from you on how you are and how things are, we would just briefly introduce you. Oleksiy Stolyarenko is the head of the IT and TMT industry group at Baker McKenzie in Kyiv. So he's focusing on IP and technology law matters, working in a big international firm. We'll certainly talk about this a little further. He's co-chair of the IP Rights Committee in the American Chamber of e-commerce in Ukraine. He's a regular visitor of the International Trademark Association. And this is where we know each other from. Welcome, Oleksiy.
Yep. Hello, everyone, once again.
Hi, Oleksiy. We also have Nazar Chernyavsky. He's CEO of the law firm Sayenko Karenko in the Ukraine. I learned that you're with the firm for 17 years now. And as I already knew, you're specialized on data protection and cybersecurity. You're currently the vice chair of the IBA Technology Committee. That's where we met. I think last time we saw each other was last year in Berlin, not too long ago. You started the Breathe Charity Fund, about which we will learn more later, I hope. And I saw on LinkedIn that you published a couple of information on law changes due to the war that I hope to learn more about later as well. And I also learned that your firm joined to found forrefugees.info, an online source of information for people forced to leave their home country. So you've been very, very active, not only before the war, but also for the last couple of weeks. And I'm very excited to hear from both of you and learn how the situation is. So shall we just jump right into the questions?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the obviously we ask, we're used to asking how you are. and whilst it's sometimes it's just seems just like a formality, how are you, Nazar? How is things for you?
Yeah, it's when you were describing all those prior activities and like the conference in Berlin last year, so it feels like it was in some other life, because nowadays it has all changed. And even my partner today was talking that maybe I'll need to do a meeting and perhaps I shall put on my suit and tie, although I don't feel it's necessary any longer, because at the moment he is wearing this camouflage uniform and that's how people live currently. So we all have to focus on something different, and preferably that has to be a focus on something meaningful and something which could help Ukraine to overcome all these hardships and effectively to win the war. Because I believe it's very important that everyone in Ukraine, despite all those horrible things, people feel optimistic. They feel that, we will still win it. Yeah, obviously, there will be many losses, victims, but I think at the moment, the whole nation feels like very unified, effectively, because and everyone is trying to help by whatever means possible. And that was the reason why we allowed at our office to do what everyone believes will help the country, because as you can appreciate, client work has dropped significantly during the last few weeks.
Sure.
And as a result, people just have to do something and trying to be useful. So for the first week or two, we allowed
maybe Nazar, we come to this a little later on how what you're actually doing in your offices or work from home. Alexei, you just told us that you just returned from Bucha yesterday. How are you?
So just about a few words about like all my well-being, and I'm very happy that my family, my relatives are fine. I'm also fine. I spent the whole Russian war with Ukraine in Kiev here. Different stages. It was very different. Right now, I concur with Nazar. Kiev is getting back to life. And of course, the next stage is that the Russians, we kicked them out from the Kyiv region, and people are starting to get back to their apartments in Bucha, in Vorzel, in Irpin, in other cities. So yesterday, with my friends, who also my neighbors, we went there to check out on our apartments and houses of our relatives, of people we know, and so on and so forth. So it was very emotional because many people were thinking that they have lost their houses. You know, that many apartments were looted, and both were like sad emotions when people found that the apartments, like my neighbor whom I brought yesterday to Bucha, in my residence building, he found that his apartment was looted, and we helped him to, you know, a little bit to restore the door, to keep things in light. And but my other my friend from Vorzel, he brought him there. He found his car, which he left in Vorzel. It was amazing. Also, he have found that his apartment building in Vorzel remained sort of untouched by Russians, which is a happy news, because they thought it was like already gone.
So you know, there were no information whilst you were in Kyiv. You didn't know at all what was going on in Bucha. All of this, so discovering the terrible war crimes that were committed there was for you like news as it was for us, obviously.
It's a very little bit different because in Bucha there were like some reports. But there was no effective connection. Like the telephone communication restored 2 days or 3 days ago. So we saw some pictures. You know, the journalists then went there. But when you want to know about like your particular building, your neighbors, it's hardly to find some information there. The military restricted access to these territories to do. To mine clearance, and you know, obviously you heard about the bodies, so they removed the bodies. So yesterday was the first time when, you know, the civilians from outside of Bucha, Irpin, Vorzel were allowed to visit. So that's where we went immediately, because we wanted to check on many things, like and the people and everything.
And is this where you actually live? Is Bucha, or is that your hometown where you come? Where you, because you said you stayed in Kyiv. Did you basically go to Kyiv just during the war, or did you, or do you live in Bucha?
So I used to live in Bucha. So it's Bucha is a nice suburb of Kyiv where you can sort of when you're short on cash, you can buy an apartment in Bucha, and that was my first apartment I ever owned. So after that, we got a little bit tired of transit from Bucha to Kyiv because we work in Kyiv. And my son was born and we spent some first time in Bucha. And because the transit takes around 1 hour, so that's effectively means that we would not see my son, awake. Because when I come from work, he would be already sleeping. When I go to work, he is still sleeping. So that's why we have changed, location to Kyiv. But otherwise, I think if, that would be possible, Bucha is a perfect place to live. It was nice neighborhood. I had, it's a great thing. We get married there. So it's a place where I still touched. So I keep my apartment there. And obviously, I keep in touch with my neighbors, and we have friends in the area. So that's a very, very, let's say, dear city for me, even though I don't currently live there. I live in Kyiv.
Okay. And Nazar, you live in Kyiv too, right? Or are you still in Kyiv?
Yes. Now? No, at the moment, I moved to the west of Ukraine, to Lviv. Actually, we spent the first week in Kyiv with my family. But then we just realized that, the risk is getting higher. And so for that reason, as a first priority was to move the family into safety. So we decided to move together with a few other families and together with our parents. So we moved all together to the West. So my family went abroad. And I'm coordinating it from here. And that was actually a good decision as well, because as it turned out, you are more efficient when you don't have to run many times to the bomb shelter, so that you can actually spend more time in front of the computer and on the phone. But coming back to Bucha, I have a few friends who were actually, I will tell you two stories, first-hand stories. So one story is about my very good friend who lived in Irpin. That's another smaller town, very similar to Bucha. So that's, and I think it's even closer to Kyiv. So it's basically same distance, and it has become the subject of the same violence as Bucha. So what he told me, they spent a few weeks there, when the fighting was going on. And then he just decided that, they need to run because they were already for 3 days without electricity, without communication, hiding in the shelter. And it was not even a proper shelter. It was a kind of a cellar under the house where it was cold, no combs, no electricity. So, and then he decided to run with his wife and his kid. And they were told, look, the only chance for you is to run through the territory which is controlled by Russians. Don't take the car, anything, because they will most likely shoot in the car. And then they were running through the field because he said that, look, we needed to run 500 meters through the field, which is an open field, until we reach the positions of Ukrainian armed forces. And when they were arriving, he said, we were falling 3 times on the ground because the... I just forgot the name of this mine launcher, if you know what it means. So it's kind of a smaller artillery was shooting, and there were explosions around them. So they few times they fell on the ground when there were explosions next to them, and then they finally reached the positions of the armed forces, and then they were able just by some miracle to, they walked on the road, and then there was some car coming by and they picked them up, like a few other people walking on that road as well. So they escaped by mere chance. And because they were brave enough to cross that field with shootings and explosions. But who knows, if they stayed, who knows what would happen to them. And there is another story which happened to the partner of our firm. And that's indeed a very, I would say, also miraculous story, because she went to her parents' house, like village house, in the, like, just a few days before the war started. Because obviously there were many discussions about the war. So she decided, okay, I'll go to that small village house, which is really old village house, nothing fancy. And then, so she spent there like a week or maybe 10 days while we still had communications with her. I think it was like about a week, but they were occupied on the third day of the war. So because that village was to the north from Kiev. So it was like in the direction of Chernobyl. So it was occupied very fast. And then, like, after a week or so, the communication was shut down and we lost any communication with her. And we just heard some information from militaries that there is a lot of military equipment in that village. So, and there is no chance to enter it or rescue anyone. So it's basically, it's locked. And then it was such a relief when first... a week ago, they, like, her husband called us and said, okay, we are fine, we are alive, like, all is good. And then yesterday she went out of that village. So they finally could get out of it. And I believe the only reason why they survived, because, yeah, she said they were just hiding in the house, not going out, was because it was really a small village. And Russians did not expect any... opposition there. So they just passed through it and put their like checkpoint and that's it. And then when they were retreating, so luckily they did not set it on fire or anything like that. So that's why we were really happy to see her again, because she was the only employee of our firm who was like disconnected for a month almost.
So with the others, you're still in touch? Or try to stay in touch?
Yes.
Okay, great. Because
we have constant calls with all the people. So, and our HR monitors like checks with everyone, like if everything is good, where they are, if they plan to move to any other location. So at the moment, basically, we know where is everyone. So there are few people in the army now, some people are abroad, some people are in Kiev, some people are in the western Ukraine or in other parts of Ukraine. So yeah, but everyone is in safety, at least.
What about you, Alexei? How did, what about your colleagues? How many are about, like went abroad, went to wherever, and yeah, where are they? Do you know?
Yep. Yeah, so we basically doing the same checks as Nazar's firm as well. So we in touch with all of the people. We have the figures. Some people went abroad. Some people are still in Kiev area, around 17 people from our firm. We have sort of all... the chats and all communication established for every group of people everywhere in Ukraine and abroad, so we can, you know, be in constant contact with them. We also have a daily, actually several times a day, we have check-ins. So if you're getting a message if you need to report that you are unsafe or something like that, you will just push a bot button and the firm will contact you back. So we're doing quite a lot of things to keep the situation in check and organized. Our colleagues are also happy to report that all of them safe. We had some incidents in the beginning of the war when people left Kiev and they went to places, you know, same as Nazar said, which they thought are safer territories. Like, for example, one of our colleagues, she went to Chernihiv. Chernihiv is a city on the north of Kiev. And her parents, they had an apartment in the center, you know, in city center, like downtown. And because you probably heard what happened to Chernihiv. So the bombardment was so hard. So they were staying in the basement and they were keeping, you know, they were trying to keep the walls because they were thinking that the walls will just go down. So yeah, thankfully they left Chernihiv, and right now Chernihiv is getting restored. But so yeah, some of the people have been caught in these situations. Also, the people from many, let's say, foreigners as well. They were because the Russian invasion was really fast. Like for example, in Bucha, they were in Bucha on the 25th, so the
just one day after the war started, basically.
One day after the war. So when you're talking about like people escaping, I mean, unless you have, you know, the car ready, full of gas tank and everything is packed, people will like, okay, is it serious? Is not serious? And many people are being under occupation because they were like, you know, one day late and it's already, you know, the Russian army is entering Bucha city and suburbs and attacking Chernihiv and so on and so forth. So it was really fast. And so that's why many people, you know, they had these situations like they were being in occupied territories. So they just, you know, thought that, okay, Kiev is probably the main target. We'll go to village and it would be safer there. And it's not always the case because the villages were occupied as well. And the city administrations like were established sort of city administrations by Russians. But the firm-wise, it's actually looking quite good. We have the coordination committee who helps people to leave the country, who educates them about the rules of immigration, how you go, where you go. People are being brought to Ukrainian border, being picked up at Ukrainian border, you know, in Poland, in Romania, in other countries. And we also have our offices who abroad, who if you need the, like a space to work or something like that, so they will help. They will help with accommodation. So basically, our office has been very, very helpful. I think it's like it's enormous effort of so many people who have been you know, invested in this operation, and it's so far. From my where I see it, it's like went very well.
It's you know, from our point of view, what we heard, I think I can say for many people that we've been very, very impressed by the I don't know if I can say positive spirit, but by the spirit of the Ukrainians, how they work together, how they, you know, deal with the whole situation. You know, that has been very, very impressive. People helping each other. I don't even know if I can ask the question, but I will do. With people everywhere, with the whole situation that you have to face, are you even working? Like, is your firm up and running or parts of it? How can we imagine working in these days in Ukraine? Nazar, maybe you want to start.
I can comment on this part. Surprisingly, we are still working, and obviously it required some effort to, you know, to consolidate people. And I had to spend personally a lot of time on all sorts of calls, town hall meetings, partner calls, practice calls, administrative staff calls, and basically trying to put together everyone. And I think for the time being, we succeeded. So obviously there are still few people who are so like, I don't know, depressed or shocked that they frankly said, look, we can't do anything now. And we, for instance, one person very openly said, look, because he was supposed to deal with our website. And then we said, okay, look, there is no work at the moment. So maybe let's use this opportunity to like improve our website or something like that. And he said, look, I can't do anything like a website because it's so ridiculous to work with a website.
Work on the data privacy policy for the website. Like it's yeah, I understand.
On the one hand, I understand. On the other hand, it's like you said earlier, Nazar, it's, you know, everyone probably has to decide, is it better for me to just, you know, or am I able to work? Or maybe it even helps to get distracted, to not, you know, fall into depression.
Yeah, that's it. And I believe like my own recipe that you have to work to overcome it. And as it turned out, it helps. And there are some practices now which got quite busy. For instance, our finance practice is quite busy because now we work with a number of foreign institutions who provide loans to Ukraine and all those support programs. So something we are working on. Then our tax practice is quite busy now because there have been so many legislative changes at the moment that they completely revamped the taxation system in Ukraine at the moment for the time of the war. And we also work with our clients, explaining to them how it works and helping them to set up like new structures. And then another part of it, relocation, because many businesses which were hit in other parts of the country, they are now trying to renew their operations. And actually, it's the official line of the government. The government said, look, everyone should continue working. You can't just go to war like so. All the people cannot take machine guns and go fighting. There should be someone who is making bread, who is making steel, who is driving trucks, and so on. So people should be working, economy should be working, taxes should be paid, and basically the country should be operational. And for that reason, there is the whole program in Ukraine which deals with relocation of businesses to the safe areas. So many businesses just relocate. And the government helps them to find the warehouses, some office spaces, some accommodation for their workers, so that they can actually resume their operations at the new place.
And this is what you would be helping then, with. This is what you'd be like rental contracts and stuff like that. That is relocation business.
That's also part of work. Yeah. And then we also have the IT sector, which also faced the same issues. But unlike many other industries, IT can resume its work quite fast. So they just really need just a safe place. A safe place with the internet connection. And that also combined with the previous efforts of the Ukrainian government regarding the creation of special like tax regime for legal and tax regime for IT companies, which is called DSCT, which effectively provided favorable taxation treatment for all IT businesses in Ukraine. And now those IT businesses accelerate with getting registered within this special regime, because it also provides some additional benefits to them, especially relevant during the wartime, because in particular, there are some discussions with the Ministry of Digital Transformation that, let's say, employees of the IT companies in this DSCT regime who continue their operations and continue paying taxes, so they will not be conscripted to the army. So which is also quite important for businesses, because it's another major business disruption, especially if there are no clear-cut rules that you cannot take to the army, you know, all men in the company, because then, I mean, the business will be derailed. Mm-hmm. So there are just certain criteria according to which such things have to be done. Let's say some specific people who have prior military experience or special training, then yes, they can go to the army, but it does not make much sense if you take to the army some IT guy, you know, just...
We certainly wouldn't benefit the German army if I would join. seriously, it's what, you know, I mean, you guys are lawyers, you know, I myself have never been in the army. What would I when we heard no Ukrainian men were allowed to leave the country, I was thinking... You know, what exactly would be my help if that happened here? And I completely agree and understand that it makes sense to help or keep everything else running. Alexei, you mentioned earlier, or both of you actually said that that you feel and have a responsibility for your employees, and you kind of call them and even have checks on whether they are well for them to notify. Is that something you do because you're such a good employer, or is that something that basically everybody, all companies do? So in terms of to look after your employees, and if everybody looks for their employees, everybody is looked for. Or how does that work? Is that just you?
Yeah, just I want to get back a little bit to the question whether we are working.
Yeah.
We do work. We continue to operate and we keep in touch with our clients. Indeed, the amounts of work has been dropped. However, we are still doing some work and... especially like the Ukrainian patent office. So I'm IP IT lawyer. Yes. So Ukrainian patent office, strangely enough, operates through all of the war. So if, for example, clients, they have IP filings to do or renewals or oppositions or anything like that, it's all working right now. We use the electronic filing system. So through this electronic filing system, we don't need to go actually to Ukrainian patent office to do that. So it works well. What all right owners should know, around 1 week ago, the Ukrainian parliament has adopted a law that suspends terms for the prosecution processes. So, for example, if you had some date to have due, like to respond on opposition, or you had some date to file some additional documents to your filing, to your trademark, patent application, so these terms are suspended to the martial law period. So it's not late to do it even right now. If you think you have lost like some priority or anything like that, it's still possible to do that. So, and it will be possible until the end of the martial law period. So it's the right time for the companies to review their IP portfolios in Ukraine. If anything need to be dealt with, like trademark application renewed or something like that, it could be done. So we do it like for many clients right now, looking through their portfolio, giving them what they need to do. And there is no rush at the moment. So we can do that as well. So this is like a very important part of my work. We have other things going on. There are some of the courts actually working. We will be checking with other courts, how the courts are resuming their work. Many other institutions are also in different stages. So many processes which we were going through, like, the anti-monopoly filing or something like that, they were stopped at some point, but now we will be checking with all of the government agencies how we can resume and how we can move forward. It's not like a straightforward process, but I think it will be resolved. I think what also Nazar has said is also what we are doing. We understand this war is not, you know, conventional war. So we are fighting on all fronts. Like we, economic front is very important. We need to keep going. We need to keep, you know, the money flow. Like I go to local coffee shop. You can see my updates on LinkedIn and that. I drink coffee because, you know, the coffee shops are part of the Ukrainian economy. And we need to keep that running. And all people who are able to do economic, you know, some product, some economic benefit to the country, they definitely should do that. And this is like one of the things which is my top priority of doing, except other things I'm doing. So it's very important. And we are very determined in that because, you know, one thing is to win the war. Another thing is to rebuild Ukraine and to recover our economy. And until that would be done, no Ukrainian would be safe because, you know, this is very much economic war, which we are having now as same as the military, as same as other aspects like information war and so on and so forth.
It's so logical, Alexei, and brave at the same time to just and I mean, we haven't said this before, but it's so obvious how everybody in, well, at least in my, the people I talk to, is just amazed by how brave you guys are and how, how you keep doing what you think it needs to be done, including drinking coffee to help a coffee shop that, you know, that you said earlier needs to pay taxes to keep the economy running and not just the military. And as you say, if the Ukrainian economy is dead after the war, Ukraine will be dead. So I guess that it is a very important point to make. And that probably helps in, I mean, luckily for us, you told us the like some way positive stories about people that could flee, lost their homes, maybe like your neighbor, but you know that they at least are safe, and these stories, and then the outlook that, you know, things may get better somewhen, or maybe hopefully soon, gives you the positiveness to keep on doing. And as you said, Nazar, it's, you know, to stay positive is as important as hard as it may be. And,
But speaking of things that can be done, Nazar, can you tell us about Breathe? What is it? What are you doing? How can we participate?
That has become one of our major focuses after the war started. Breathe is a charity which was established by a few partners of our firm together with some other friends, like businessmen at the beginning of the COVID pandemics, because back then we also had a significant problem of medical supplies for Ukrainian hospitals. So we were basically raising money and buying ventilators for the hospitals as well as other protective equipment. And then after pandemics was getting down. So we were supporting some hospitals in from time to time. Obviously the volume of the operations was not that big, but after the war started, we realized, okay, we already have a ready vehicle. And then we also have a lot of contacts internationally, not only in Ukraine. And that's how we can help the country. And we also had an internal discussions what should be the focus of this charity, because at the beginning, I would say that most of the donations in Ukraine would go to armed vests and all kinds of other support for the army. including some scopes, like thermal scopes, and other stuff, basically to helmets, and anything else. But then we realized, okay, we should not forget that there are wounded and there are people who are still at hospitals, not only because of the war, but who have been sick or who got sick or who got injured and so on. And because the general focus shifted to the war and everything which is like basically war oriented, then there are some vulnerable categories which needed extra protection. And that's what we started doing. We started helping kids' hospitals. We started helping hospices for elderly people and regular hospitals. So the focus was medicines and medical equipment because currently many hospitals lack it for various reasons, because they don't have sufficient funding, but the demand increased because there are a lot of injured people coming there. Sometimes there are issues with the logistics because they simply cannot get the necessary medicines. And that was also a challenge, for instance, just a few weeks ago when Chernihiv and Sumy were still like in the middle of like a Russian offensive. We were sending medicines to those hospitals because we saw that they really needed it, and there were very few ways to organize the delivery of medicines there.
So much more than just much more than just like donating money, but actually doing the logistics, buying the stuff, the medicine and the medical equipment, and
yes,
getting it there.
Yes, and that's how we use our people now as well, because as we discussed previously, the amount of the client work has dropped. Yeah, we do some client work. We do write legal alerts and other stuff, but still, some people don't have enough work to do. But at the same time, we keep all the team together, and we said, okay, guys, you can help. You can help to the charity. So let's work as volunteers. And they do the calls, they talk to the suppliers, they talk to the delivery companies, they organize the delivery across the border, and then they organize the delivery like from the border to the hotspots where those products are needed. They do the fundraising. Actually, fundraising is mostly done by our senior staff because people who have more contacts. And I have to say that indeed we are using now our reputation, our contacts to raise money for that. But at the same time, for instance, I feel 100% comfortable that all the money raised would go for a good cause, because we are in full control of what is being done with the money. So it's not like we are just transiting it to someone who then does something with that.
And that's a very, very good reason, I think, for people listening. If you are still looking for a chance to donate and, you know, want to be sure that the money you donate comes to the right place by the right people, we will put the link in the short notes, and people can use that to donate money to your charity.
Yeah, that would be great, because as we see, money is running out fast. Although we still had a couple of big donations from some US law firms, and we are very grateful to them. Not only US, actually, I have to say that even German, English, either firms or individuals have been donating quite generously, but we just recently got some really big donations. So, and which created certain reserve for us, and now we can be more efficient, because obviously when you are able to buy a bigger installment of medicine, then it's easier to organize everything, because it's not like you're buying just
two boxes of something in the pharmacy. So that's a different scale and a different efficiency.
Alexei, I mean, I have to say a lot of the information we receive of the war, at least is how I consume it, is via LinkedIn, actually, via the people that are there, which is you and others that we actually know and know what they're doing. And you said I remember one post of you saying the international community of IP lawyers in that case kind of sticks together. Always go to these conferences, you see that it's actually more than just legal stuff that's been building up. I know, Alexei, that you have also done, or your firm has also done stuff. If you want to tell us nonprofit and charity stuff, if you want to tell us a little bit about what you are doing and your firm is doing, if you want.
Our firm is supporting UNHCR. We have launched a joint program. This is a UN refugee agency, which is responsible for all people who are displaced and refugees from Ukraine who left abroad. But we also have around 8 million, I think, internal displaced persons who are left contact lines and are staying, like Nazare, for example. He is also an internally displaced person who left Kiev and stays in Lviv. So we have quite a lot of people who need help, and our firm is contributing to UNHCR. I'm personally doing two initiatives. First initiative is I'm collaborating with, as you have guessed correctly, IP lawyers and the charitable foundation COLO, which is circle in English. This is charitable foundation launched by IP lawyers whom I know for many years in 2014. So they were helping people who suffered from the Russian aggression from 2014, but also the army. So now two of these lawyers who has launched this charitable foundation, they enlisted to the army. So they fight in the army ranks, actually defending Kiev. So I was brought to strengthen this charitable foundation and also doing fundraising. So this is this money would go to different types of ammunition, not like weapons, but for example drones or we are now expecting some chemical attacks. So there might be some protective gear to protect from chemical weapons and so on and so forth. So that's very important, and I think. Basically, if you calculating, the contribution which you can make, like the best investment you can do right now, you should invest in Ukrainian army, because the more Ukrainian army is capable of, the less refugees we need, we will face, we will have the less, a crisis in all the spheres. So it's where I personally invest quite a lot of money. So I invest in Ukrainian army. So the second initiative, which is more like a small scale. So I collect money and we buy IFAC first aid kits. These are kits which I use to stop bleeding during the traumatic events. Like it's not only for the army, it's like for any a traumatic event which opens leads to an open wound and extensive bleeding, which are very common during the armed conflicts, the shelling, like you can even break your arm or something like that. So the idea of this kit is that most people do not survive 30 minutes after this, because of the loss of blood. So if you stop the blood, the bleeding, then the person can be brought to safety to the hospital and be saved. So that's the whole meaning of this pack, which is not very cheap. I would say it's like 80, depending on combination, up to $100 per first aid kit, even sometimes even more, $100. So we are buying these in different locations. Right now we are buying them from Turkey and bringing them to Ukraine. We will check this logistics. As Nazar said, logistics, everything is complicated. So we are figuring it out, and we will be buying more in the nearest future. We already bought some tourniquets. Tourniquets is also a device used to stop bleeding. So we will be, we checked already them. So it's like lots of work going on through this. So these are two initiatives for this one. I collect money personally on my PayPal, and for charitable foundation Kola, we have, you know, the all the fund requisites in all currencies, so no problems there as well.
So to all listeners, you know what to do. We'll put everything in the show notes, and then you can be sure that anything that's been donated or that will be donated is in good hands with Alexei and Nazar's charitable organizations. And I think that, again, also personally for me hosting this, do it. And as you say, investing in the Ukrainian army and in the Ukrainian people. Personally, we have done, I mean, obviously in Germany, you know, we're astounded and cannot believe it, but a lot of colleagues have helped. We have, you know, with accommodation, with buying stuff, with donating money, with actually driving to the Ukrainian border to deliver goods and all of this. But obviously it needs to, the war needs to end, and it needs to end in a good way. So I agree that investing in the Ukrainian army in weapons to be used, I think, is something that needs to be done now. And also, I think when talking about what can we do, one of the things that I always read in posts of Ukrainian colleagues is, put pressure on your government to you know, obviously we're having this. The issue of gas from Russia, that is like the most obvious issue. And I understand it's not as easy to just, you know, stop it, but we need to solve this and do everything we can to stop funding the Russian aggression and divert the money to where it should be used. One last question that I was interested. Do you see a special role for lawyers in this war? You already say, I found it very interesting how you said you take care of your employees and divert the work to charity. Is there something that you said that only lawyers can do in this war?
I can probably say a few words what we do, because I believe one of the biggest issues at the moment, which is still an unresolved issue, is retrieving damages from Russia. Because obviously all the damage they caused to the Ukrainian economy, yeah, to the businesses, to people.
To private individuals who find their iPhones in Belarus now while tracking devices.
Starts from there and it goes up to those huge factories totally demolished and all like airports or seaports destroyed. So that's like huge damage to the whole infrastructure. And obviously I believe that's a part of the legal front. Like how to get some compensation from Russia, and that's a very challenging issue, obviously, mm-hmm. because it's similar to the gas issue. Because I believe at the moment you should stop it, because the current Russian regime just has to be stopped. It has to be, you know, destroyed. Then perhaps you can renew some supplies from the new, from a different Russia, like from a different country. Yeah. hopefully we will see that coming. And same goes about compensations. I think after the change of the regime, so such compensation conditions may be possible. Like, but at the moment, really, it's a very legally challenging issue. Like, how to do it? Because obviously, Russia will not agree to any consensual ways of doing it. So they put a veto on everything which goes through the United Nations. They block everything else. So the only way left is like to stop seizing their assets. But then I believe many European countries realize that when they start seizing Russian assets, Russia will start seizing assets of the European companies who are there. And that's actually another reason why we are also lobbying with all our international friends, especially with lawyers who have some influence on their clients, to quit Russia as soon as possible, basically, to because the longer you stay there, the more difficult it will be to pull out later, because then I think Russians will start taking some leverage over those companies, like they already do. Like, they blackmail a company that, okay, if you stop operations, we'll just expropriate your assets and take them and keep using them on our own. So there are a lot of legal issues here, and I think that lawyers will be busy with that. There are some other issues as well, like the refugee crisis, the all sorts of legislation changes, the reconstruction of the country, because I believe we will need many new laws, including the harmonization of the Ukrainian legislation to get it in line with the EU, because as you know, a Ukrainian application has been accepted, but yeah, in order for it to succeed, a lot of legislative changes have to be made as well. And that is also work for the lawyers. I think the only thing which we really need to remember, and that was the thing which I told my partners on the first day of the war, that look, we will have some work, so there will be things to do, like after the war, but only if we win this war. Because if we lose this war and there is no Ukraine left, I mean, there will be no legal business for us. that's it. So that's why our first priority is to help the country to win the war.
I will add a couple of words to what Nazar said. I completely agree with that. The challenge we are now facing has many dimensions, like a legal dimension is one of them. And in addition to the humanitarian crisis, the new policies that need to be established in relation to immigration, support of refugees, Ukrainians abroad, and so on, one aspect which I also want the lawyer community to look at is the export control, the sanctions, and basically the idea is to create a new system to avoid Russia and Russian government companies escaping, you know, all sanctions and all export control issues. Like, for example, they would just create another company which is not under the sanctions to buy sanctioned ammunition and technology. And it's important to every lawyer to understand that all these vehicles, all these instruments being used to avoid the sanction control directly leading, you know, to casualties in Ukraine. Like, you know, the ballistic missiles Russians using to shoot Ukraine, Kyiv. Nazar said we have so many airstrikes alerts in Kyiv. We do. We have like 3 or 4 airstrike alerts in Kyiv every day. So all these ballistic missiles, they use foreign technology, foreign parts in them. So we just need to completely, you know, seize this opportunity for Russia to buy these parts, to buy this technology through any vehicles, even if they launched somewhere else in the world, like, you know, through any other countries and so on and so forth. So that's very important effort. And also As you know, we are continuing in this war and in creation of the new regulatory landscape. We probably would need to think about some system how to avoid any possible wars like that happen ever again. Because as you have seen, like we are in war with Russia for already 8 years, and they during all these 8 years they are buying this technology to build in their ballistic missiles. It's a little bit crazy if you think about it, and on all other aspects as well. So the work ahead is quite big. Restoring Ukraine, restoring Ukrainian economy, prompting all other players on the market and creating new rules so that will not happen again.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. It's certainly be the toughest episode of this podcast. I'm very happy and that you joined and let us know how things are in the Ukraine. One of the many things I took with us was how also international lawyers can help, not just donating money, but also see that sanctions are enforced. And that is certainly something that we can all look at. Tough to finish this. I'll make it short. To all listeners, have a look at the show notes. We'll link to the initiatives of these two brave gentlemen, and then donate whatever you can to help. Help the war to end and Ukraine to be back. And I also look last word. I'm very amazed by the positiveness and the talk about restoring Ukraine already, which is of course the way to go. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Martin and Marlene. Thanks a lot for your support and for giving us a chance to talk here.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts and the facts and the your experiences. It has been very touching and inspiring, and I really hope to talk to you again soon, and moreover to see you again soon with better circumstances. Take care.
For sure. We'll stay in touch.
Definitely. Thanks. Yes. Keep safe.
Bye.